Hi, welcome. Nice to see you all. Okay. So, back to work again today.
A lot of work.
Holiday over. Sorry? Yeah, but I've been a lot of practice today already. So, if I remember correctly, that the last time we were reading from the word of the Buddha, we got to, well, I've got page 73, and we're going to go to the Samasati, and they have here the Nirvana through Anapanasati. Is that correct? Okay, so what I'm going to do here, because this is an old translation, and I might as well use the latest translation from the Majjhima, the Mindfulness of Breathing. So you can follow it in your one. But I'm also going to read it from the latest translation, obviously by Bhikkhu Bodhi, based on from Jnanaponika's translation. Same thing, okay. It's Nibbana through Anapanasati. So here we go. I'll do the Namotasa first of all. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So you can follow it with the earlier translation by Venerable Jnanatiloka, and I'll be reading this one, which was from Bhikkhu Bodhi, based on Jnanaponika's translation. So Jnanamoli, yeah. It was Jnanamoli, was it? Yeah. It was Jnanamoli's one, yes. So we have here the fulfillment of the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay, then they've got it sort of abbreviated here. So I'll read out from this. Watching from your book first of all, watching over in and out breathing, anapanasati, practice and develop streams of four foundations of mindfulness, the satipatthana, to perfections. And the four foundations of mindfulness, practice and develop, bring the seven elements of enlightenment to perfection, the bojangas. And the seven elements of enlightenment, practice and develop, bring wisdom and deliverance to perfection. But how does watching over in and out breathe, practice and develop, bring the four foundations of mindfulness to perfection? And this is where we come on to here. Oh, it's gone up again. And how, bhikkhus, do the four foundations of mindfulness developed and cultivated fulfill the seven enlightenment factors? Bhikkhus, on whatever occasion a monk abides, and how monks or bhikkhus does mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness? Monks, on whatever occasion, this is number one in that list there, on whatever occasion a bhikkhu breathing in long understands I breathe in long, or breathing out long understands I breathe out long, breathing in short understands I breathe in short, or breathing out short understands I breathe out short, or trains thus I shall breathe and experience the whole body of breath they have in brackets in the new translation, trains thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of breath, trains thus, or shall breathe in, tranquilizing the body formation, trains thus, or I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the body formation. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating the body, as body has here, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. I say that this is a certain body among the bodies, namely in-breathing and out-breathing. That is why on that occasion a monk abides contemplating the body's body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. That's number one there. Now, first of all, to make the comments on that statement there, that first of all you see there that they count the in-breath as kaya. It's one of the kayas. As they say, a body amongst many different types of bodies. As I mentioned before, that the word kaya in Pali is used as a word denoting any aggregate of things, any group of things. And it does fit with the English word body very, very accurate, because the word body in English does mean our physical body, but it also does mean, as I've mentioned before, like a body of soldiers, or a body of evidence in law, you know, a body of data. It can be something which is incorporate It is used very widely in English, as it is used in Pali as well. If you read the Pali, you see things such as, Rupakaya and Manakaya, even Dhammakaya is used once in the suttas, like a body of Dhamma. So it's quite clear there that the body does not always mean the physical body. And that's quite important there, because when you say body awareness, even here it shows that this is doing the anapanasati on the breath, and when we get to experiencing the whole body of breath, or the whole body here, at that particular time it does not mean just feeling the sensations in your body. It's actually very clear here, it does mean the whole body of the breath, the whole aggregate of breath moments. And as I've described it to you in many talks before, it is like noticing the very beginning of the in-breath and noticing every moment of breath until it reaches the end of the in-breath. Just one whole series of experiences, and even seeing the gap between the breath and seeing the beginning of the out-breath, right at the very beginning to the end of the out-breath. In other words, seeing just a whole aggregate of experiences which account for one in-breath and one out-breath. And when one uses kaya in this particular sense as aggregate, the whole aggregate of breath, it makes it very clear. Unfortunately, but when he mentions body here, there are still a number of people who, in spite of passages such as this, where it says the breath is a body amongst bodies, which is very clear in this passage here, they still think that this particular time you should stop worrying about the breath and just feel the physical sensations in the body.
It's a whole school of thought. It's a whole controversy.
It's a controversy there, but number one, in experience of the way we've been taught for many years, they always say just keep the breath in mind for this particular four first steps of Anapanasati, for the 16. And we often quote this because why is this called body contemplation when you're just watching the breath? It's because I say this is a certain kaya amongst kaya. This is what it means. It's the third type of aggregate, the breath. So it does actually mean when the Buddha says this breath is kaya here, one of the kayas. So therefore, when you say be thou experiencing the whole body of breath, it does actually mean the breath. And Vedanyana Bodhi and Bhikkhu Bodhi sort of appreciate that, and that's why they have that in the translation, the new translation. Yeah, I'm not sure who started it, but it's very much the case that you're watching the whole breath. So you don't just train, watch the in-breath and the out-breath, and then you let the breath go and just watch the physical feelings in the body. You're watching the whole body of the breath. You're focusing so that breath, the whole body can actually soon disappear.
Wouldn't it make sense also because it goes from the Olarapa to Sukhuma, gets more refined, it would be bigger that way if it went to the body.
Indeed. When you understand ekagata, which is one of the goals of the meditation, as being not just one pointedness of mind, as I mentioned before, but one peak of mind. It's a singleness, a very high single experience. So where many things have disappeared. But it's also very important. Many of you will probably know that there are some similes to jhanas, which will come across, I don't think it's mentioned in here. It's a shame because they're very good similes of things like putting a white cloth over the body. And or experiencing just the whole body. Now those are not to be meant as a physical body, because as I've mentioned many times, in the jhanas the body's totally gone. You can't experience the body. And that again has confused people. The confusion comes with the understanding of the word kaya, which, you know, does mean body, but not physical body. It can mean body in all the other senses that the English word possesses. You know, you have in the United States a body of senators.
Body politic,
yeah. It just means any group of things, yes.
In the case of the fourth jhana, what is the body specifically in that case?
It means the aggregate of experiences which you have in that state of mind.
Okay.
So the whole thing, the whole experience sort of is just covered in peace and stillness. So it's not the body. It's not meant to be sort of the body. That's where similes can sometimes be misleading. because a simile is just meant to convey one aspect, or the simile has one aspect which is meant to sort of convey the meaning of that particular state. And sometimes similes can be extended far beyond their original meaning.
Also, similes can only be terms in five senses in the language as a whole.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's a good example, like the simile of the raft for crossing the stream. That doesn't mean to become enlightened you have to go into the wood and cut some wood and make a raft for yourself. And that's a simile, okay? So don't take it further than it's meant. Okay. Yeah? Sorry, okay, I thought you said something. Okay. So we go, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of the breath, means the beginning to the end of the breath, and I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the body formation, which is tranquilizing the breath here. It's kaya sankara. So that bodily formation of the breath is like calming it down. So how do you do that?
Tell yourself.
Let it be is the best way. Because we've all seen before, like calming, tranquilizing, stilling, the old simile I have of the cup of water, which you've heard so many times. How to get the cup of water absolutely still? Not by holding it, by letting it go, disengaging. It becomes still all by itself. That's a great way of tranquilizing the breath, by leaving it alone, disengaging. It gets quiet by itself.
Quiet.
Yeah, quiet or else. Then you find you get wound up. So that's the first paragraph there, of the first four stages of Anapanasati. And he said, this is what I call, this is actually part of the first Satipatthana. Now there's something else which, I'm not sure if I mentioned before we did the Satipatthana, that on that occasion, the monk abides contemplating the body as body. Now, that is a very bad translation. I'll just finish this then. And the reason it's a bad translation is because, as most professional translators know, you never translate word by word. You translate phrase by phrase, sentence by sentence, or meaning by meaning. If you translate word by word, that's when you get all these stupid idioms in English. What's another good idiom? Like to kick the bucket. So you say, oh, you know, just my sort of, my friend in Switzerland who just kicked the bucket today. And so you translate that into sort of Pali. And they wouldn't have a clue what you're on about. You know, what's the word for bucket? What's the word for kick? Because the word kick in the bucket is like a slang term for to die. So you had kick the bucket, you'd have die. You won't have sort of, what is the Swiss word for kick? And what's bucket? Okay, so it doesn't make sense. So you've got a wrong translation. And the same here, the body in the body just means the body. And this is one of the reasons why I encourage people to learn Pali, because you know, these are just insights which I got when I first learned Pali, when you just read. The way that Pali works is when you do, you wash the dishes, you do dishwashing of dishes. They have this actually, the verb, they don't just say washing, they have like dishwashing or like clothes washing. So it's almost like a compound, clothes washing, dishwashing, car driving. And then they also have the object, you know, you car drive a car. So in Pali, you wouldn't say, no, I rode a bicycle. They'd say, I bicycle rode my bicycle. That's just the idiom there. And say, what else would you ride? If you're bicycle riding, you have to be a bicycle. If you're dishwashing, you have to wash dishes. And if you're car riding, you have to be in the car. But this is actually just the idiom of Pali. See this come again and again and again in Pali.
Why did they emphasize this point all the time in the commentaries?
They didn't actually in the commentary, but what it really says here, when it's actually commentaries which came much later when people actually didn't understand the Pali, they didn't read it for themselves. It's very obvious when you read Pali for yourself. So when it says body in the body, it just means you're contemplating the body. That's it. So if you do a real accurate translation there, you just contemplate the body. Finish. Period. Not contemplating in the body in the body. Because once you start to say that, then people have all these great theories of what it really means. What means body in the body? And that gives the license to people to philosophize and to whatever it is, and get into sort of great sort of debates. When really all it means is, you know, you sort of you watch the body. You watch the body.
Are we still talking about the breath body?
No. This is another general satipatthana. This is one of them. So here you'd say if you're watching the breath, you're doing breath watching on breath.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or what you say, you're breathing the breath. So what else would you breathe? But this is just the idiomapali. So you're still watching the body. This is a general satipatthana of being aware of the body.
Do they have other places in the suttas where they use that kind of construction?
Yes, very often.
Are they translated as weird?
Sometimes they are. But sometimes it's less physical and more practical. So it's more like, you know, you're sweeping the ground. So you're ground sweeping the ground. You're water bathing with water. And when that comes across so often, as soon as sort of something clicks, you can say, oh yeah, this must be the same with satipatthana, which is correct. So just contemplating the body. So this is one example of contemplating the body. Yes?
I have a question from before. So because Buddha said something, he has a reason for it. So I'm just wondering, why did he say, if I breathe in love, I know I breathe in love. If I breathe in short, like why should we put our attention on that aspect of the breath? And what
is that? It's a training to be done. That's why it says, you train thus, and the reason you have that is you would all know when you start meditating, if you go onto the breath too soon, you know, you can't hold the breath. You know, it just wanders off, or you fall asleep, or, you know, you have to put too much force on to hold the breath, and then you start to wander off, or you get sort of tense and doesn't work. So to be able to watch the breath, you need a lot of preparation. And part of that preparation, some people do counting methods, but part of that preparation, before you can really watch the whole breath, you have to make it interesting. In other words, just watching the breath is not enough to really grab the mind. So by making it interesting, you know if it's a long. How long? Is this extra long? Or, you know, just medium long? Or just slightly long? You know, is it short? Is it really short? Or just average short? Or, you know, just, you know, short, middling? So what that does, it makes it a little bit more interesting when you've got more to work on. The brain has got more things to think about, basically. It gives you more handles on the breath to get hold of. So you do that first of all, and as I mentioned there, it's not one thing you do first and then you do the next. You don't first of all breathe in long and then just to breathe in short. I've done stage one, now I do stage two, now I do stage three. That one, those first two, is an either, whatever your breath is, a natural breath, is it long, is it short? Is it medium? Is it, how long is it? Yeah.
I guess it may sound silly, but you know, I've been pressing this to let go. And,
yeah.
And that works fine for me. I mean, because you know, you may just, you know, let go, put the cup down and all this.
Yeah.
So should I?
That's fine. It's just whatever you need to do to get hold of the breath. Whatever works, basically.
I can stick with
that. Oh, sure, yeah. If you get something, you get to that stage, especially that stage three here, where you can breathe in and out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. Now you can see the whole breath. We always have the saying that if you want to train a tiger, you've got to capture the tiger first of all. So this is, if you want to train the breath, you've got to capture it first of all. So finding a way to capture the breath. And then you tranquilize it. And that fulfills first satipatthana. The next paragraph. On whatever occasion a bhikkhu trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing rapture, you train thus, I shall breathe out experiencing rapture, you train thus, I shall breathe in experiencing pleasure, train thus, I shall breathe out experiencing pleasure, train thus, I shall breathe in experience the mental formation, you train thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mental formation, train thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the mental formation, train thus, I shall breathe out tranquilizing the mental formation. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating feelings. Not feelings as feelings, just feelings. Ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away covetousness and greed for the world. I say that this is a certain feeling among the feelings, namely giving close attention to the in and out breathing. That is why on that occasion a monk abides contemplating feelings, ardent, fully aware mind, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now, there's an important part there, that just as the breath is counted as a body, what you're doing over here in the second tetrad, the 5 to 8 factors of anapanasati, is you're focusing on feelings, on vedana. So what that means is that aspect of the breath, which is its pleasurable or painful or in-between quality. So when you're watching the breath, it's not just breath going in and out, it's actually feeling its pleasurable, its effective quality inside. Which is why it says over here, you breathe in and out, first of all, experience the pity, and then the sukha, the rapture and the pleasure. And in Jnana Tiloka's one, what do you say over here? I just rapture and joy. There's so many different translations for pity and sukha. And again, that's one of the things as a lay Buddhist meditator, we used to argue what it actually means, the pity and sukha. And I had my theories as well, but what really shows you what those two really mean is when you attain that third jhana, when half of happiness, half of your ecstasy vanishes. And it's only when that half vanishes, you know, as you sort of enter, the third jhana, there the sukha is there, the pity is gone. Then you know what pity is. It's just a more...
physical?
Sorry?
Physical?
No, not physical. No, you're just in the mind now. It's just a more coarse form of happiness. A more sort of excitable form of happiness. That's why that joy is a pretty good word. If I was going to choose a word, I'd use joy for pity in that particular case. Or delight, and just, you know, like the happiness, or what's a nice word, satisfaction or whatever for sukha.
Can we have pity before the jhanas?
Of course.
Sometimes a hair rises on my arm, I call that pity.
Pity has got many different forms. It's a coarser form of happiness. Mm-hmm. And the point is that pity and sukha are always together. And it's only this very, very rare case of that third jhana where you have one without the other. It's just like two twins are always seen together. And it's the only occasion when they're parted. And that's why that's the only real time you can find who's who. But still, even today, I mean, there's some twins. There's a couple of twins over in Malaysia, Amata and Mangala. And you know, they love like doing the attendance service for me when I go over there. I'll be going over there again in December, and one of them is going to be, I think it's Mangala is going to be my attendant this time. And I have 50-50 chance, I always get it wrong, which one's which. Because they look identical. And you know that sometimes what happens with identical twins, I mean, they usually sort of, they do that just to tease you. But that's like pity and sukha, they're like twins. They're very hard to tell apart, but once one goes, then you know what the other one was. Yes?
So, could you just clarify this point? So, when you teach meditation, you say it doesn't matter which object you have, because they'll lead to, you know, that's what some people have metta, some people, they're just like a really peace.
Indeed.
But a Buddha is saying you should train thus.
This is just what happens. So, you have to.
It
doesn't matter what you start with, because this is just what happens. This is one way of actually fulfilling the 4 satipatthanas and thereby the 7 enlightenment factors and, you know, enlightenment. But it's a natural progression, because this is, again, when you do totally nothing, this is what happens. You can see the breath gets quiet and very peaceful, and then you're still watching the breath in these cases over here. This was the first half of this second tetrad, second 4 stages. But what's actually happening here, you've noticed that what you're really watching is the feeling of this. It's a feeling of the breath you're watching.
So we don't have to do
it. Don't have it, it's a natural.
No, this
is not something you choose to do. You may be able to get away with choosing to do this at the beginning of the meditation, but the deeper you get, the more you find that that messing around with the process just interferes and disturbs it.
Okay, so to clarify,
That's right, yeah. But when you sort of just do the way you've been describing, you'll find you experience all these stages. But it's a natural progression, they're just what happens. Just the same way as if you fall, you know, from an aircraft, you go through 10,000 meters and 9,000 meters and 8,000 meters. You don't say, now I'm going to do 7,000 meters, now I'm going to hit the ground. It just happens naturally.
Because the Buddha said, you know, if you breathe along, you have to stay. You breathe along,
yeah.
Kind of scared me. Say, oh, I don't
know.
Right.
No, no.
I think in answer to the question.
But I understand it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
The comment in here, I breathe in long, is just be aware.
That's right, yeah.
Being aware.
That's right, yeah. Just so that idea, that concept. And so you have here, first of all, you notice the rapture and the pleasure, the pity and the sukha. And you know that the way I've described meditation, this is called the delightful, the beautiful breath. And this is, again, I point this out to you because you're supposed to enjoy this meditation. It says it's what's supposed to happen. You're supposed to be experiencing rapture and pleasure. And I mention that because sometimes when meditation gets nice for some people, they say there must be something wrong. I'm going to get attached. And you're supposed to do this. So when the beautiful, delightful breath happens, don't be afraid of it. It's here. You're supposed to be doing this. And by experiencing those delightful breaths, you're actually doing satipatthana as well. And then, that seventh stage, by tranquilizing the mental formation, by the patisambhayang, the chitta sankhara. And that chitta sankhara is that joy, that peace, and you're just calming it all down. That's actually how you experience the breath at that time. As a sort of, as I sometimes said, a mental breath. When it gets delightful, this is where you are transferring from a physical breath to a mental experience of the breath. To explain it more clearly, six senses, according to the Buddha, the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the touching, and the knowing. And at this particular stage, you're not feeling the breath through the body sense. You're actually knowing the sense, knowing the breath through the mind sense. It is actually start to be a mental object. It's known by the mind, not felt by the body. That's why it starts to get delightful, because this body is painful and it's a mess. I don't know about yours. But mine does get messy. So, and how you tranquilize it, or patisambhayang is actually the word. It just means you just allow it just to settle down. So, of course, that delight begets more and more refined. The delightful breath becomes incredibly subtle. And again, you're not experiencing the body anymore, the physical body. It's just the delight of the breath, which means the body is disappearing. And that's where a lot of the peace and the joy comes from. And first of all, experiencing the mental formation, which is experiencing the pity sukha together, and then tranquilizing it. And that is called watching feelings. Now, that means that what you're doing here is you're actually watching a sensation, a feeling, an affective, a pleasure. And that's what we're supposed to be doing here, watching the pleasure of the breath. So I made that point very closely here, because that is what you're supposed to be doing, and that's actually what happens, a delightful thing. Now, we get on to the fun stuff. Whatever occasion a bhikkhu trains us, I shall breathe in experiencing the mind, which is the citta. Okay, so it's mind there. Trains us, I shall breathe out experiencing the citta. Trains us, I shall breathe in gladdening the mind, gladdening the citta. I shall breathe out, gladdening the citta. Trains us, I shall breathe out in concentrating the citta. I shall breathe out, concentrating the citta. Trains us, I shall breathe in, liberating the citta. Trains us, I shall breathe out, liberating the citta. On that occasion, a monk abides contemplating the citta, ardent, fully aware, mindful, having put away covers and grief for the world. So the mind here is citta. Okay? Now, what does that actually mean? I shall breathe in and out, experiencing the citta. Now, a lot of times people haven't got a clue what the mind means. we've always got sort of theories of what the mind is, but those theories are based on all sorts of philosophies. Now you are experiencing the citta. And for those of you who have experienced this path, you know that once you get to this beautiful, delightful breath, it's a mental breath. After the delightful breath, the thing which happens next is the nimitta, the beautiful light in the mind. And that is what is meant by experiencing the citta. As it is mentioned in many places, or not that many places, but it mentioned by the Buddha, that pabbasara cittam. What does pabbasara mean? It means this radiant mind. It says this mind is radiant when the defilements don't come into it. And that pabbasara citta is mentioned in many places. It's actually what happens when the nivaranas are disappeared. And of course, that pabbasara citta, here we've got citta, and those of you who have experienced the meditation, what can that mean? That's that beautiful light which experiences in the mind. It's not a physical light. It's not seen by the eyes. This is a metaphor, again, the only word we can actually get usually to describe it. The beautiful, beautiful light which comes in at that stage of the meditation. And this is what's supposed to happen. You're experiencing the delightful, beautiful citta. Yes. Right, yeah.
Consciousness is the sheets of
three. Yeah.
So, here, we're not actually, in that case, we're not actually experiencing consciousness, it's just an object.
Yes, good. This is just like looking at your face in the mirror. That's a common metaphor for this, used in the suttas and also used in the commentaries. So you look at your face in the mirror. How can you see your face? You can't really see your face because you know the face of the eyes. It's just similar to trying to eat your own head. But you have this wonderful thing called a mirror. So when you actually look in the mirror, you're not actually looking at your face. You're looking at the image of your face. So this nimitta is the image of the citta. And it's a brilliant simile that when you experience an image for the first time, you are actually, as it were, looking in a mirror at your citta. And that's how it appears for you. There's a light in the mind. And it is very pabbasara if you haven't had many defilements recently. As I mentioned in the talks, if you've been naughty, had a few defilements, got angry at someone, kicked the cat, or got really upset because someone said something, then when you see your nimitta, it will be mucky. Dirty, stained, it won't be so radiant. And that amateur told me, that sort of one of the twins. When I first started teaching like this, he came up to me and he said, I got a nimitta, but it was really dirty. I said, what have you been up to? He said, okay, I admit it. He had some shenanigans with somebody. So this is actually, you can't sort of get away from the fact that what you've been doing, because that's what you see, it's in a mirror. If you've got a dirty face and look in the mirror, you can actually see it there. You can't pretend otherwise.
And what's the mind, when you see, what is it reflecting in?
That I really don't know. Well, because it's just, again, I think that's taking the simile too far.
Mm.
It's just reflecting, you just see it. Not in something, but it's just how you're experiencing it.
But the mind sense all the function.
I think, yes, this is just what happens. This is the object which is most prominent for the mind. So that's what it sees. And again, the other senses have gone. You're experiencing the mind, you're not experiencing the body anymore, you're not experiencing sight, sound, or any of the other five senses. You're experiencing the mind, not the sound. Yeah.
Yeah. Why does that arise and then feel good?
is because of the stillness has got a huge amount of power and energy to the jitta.
So that so the consciousness
is so strong, stronger. So whoever shouts the loudest is the one you hear. Whichever sense is strongest is the one you perceive.
Okay, so it's like an object of the consciousness.
Yeah.
Kind of like the same way that the sight faculty and that's a sight.
Correct,
object,
yeah.
That's an object of consciousness.
Correct, yeah. Just say that what you see in the mirror is not your face, it's the object of your sight. Mm-hmm. It's just a reflection. There's a bit of interpretation going on there as well. That's called sanya. Yes.
Why is the whole nimitta thing so confusing?
It is because it's very subtle, and because most people don't even get close to that. And because it's unexplored territory for most people, that's why it takes a long time for people to get the hang of it, what it actually is. Not many people meditate, let alone actually those meditators who get to nimitta stages. This is where we get to really sort of good Buddhist stuff. This is what you're supposed to do. And that's just the first one, it's just experiencing the citta, then gladdening the citta and concentrating the citta. And those are not such good translations, especially the second one. It was just, I went over to the retreat center this morning just to see just all those emails when I was on retreat. There was about 80 emails. it was really, I was going to go back to my cave and forget them, but one of them was actually somebody who was actually writing to me from, I forget where, it's a monk, saying, he said, what do you reckon of this translation of concentration for samadhi? And he said, it's a terrible translation. I said, yeah, concentration is not samadhi. Samadhi is like stillness. Concentration is far too harsh. So I don't like that translation one bit, and this monk didn't like it either. So when we say concentrating the mind, stilling the citta. And for those of you who have had experience of nimittas, you know that it doesn't last when you first get them. Sometimes they come and they go, they can move all over the place. They are not still. So that's one of the things we have to do, to still that nimitta, so it just stays there. And the other one, the gladdening the mind, abhipamojaya is the word. Pamoja is actually another word for like joy, but this is like a deeper joy. It's making it beautiful, making it, oh, this is really nice. And this is my translation of this, and I only do this because the translation is just experiential. It's like, I call it shining the nimitta. Making it brighter and more beautiful. Just like, you know, you've got a Buddha statue and you polish it and polish it until it just glows. And that's actually what you're really doing to your jitta at this point, this nimitta, whatever it takes to really get it sort of glowing and beautiful and brilliant. And those are the two important things which need to be done. Obviously the best way of stilling the mind, that's why I actually did them the opposite way here, because stilling leads to more power in the nimitta. So I would actually encourage people, if you get to those stages, forget about trying to sort of gladden the mind. Just keep it still, and the gladness and the joy, the shine, the oomph actually just grows by itself. Stillness is the key. But there are legitimate other ways of shining up your nimitta. And one of those ways, which is, it works, is when you have a nimitta, a light in the mind. Remember, you can't really do this at the time, but you can train yourself outside of nimitta stages simply by attitude, is to look for the most beautiful part of your nimitta, which is usually the center part. And all it means is you have a positive mind state. So many people are negative mind state, which means you're always looking for what's wrong. You're always looking for what's a fault. So you see a nimitta, and you actually literally go look, where's the bad parts, you know, the naughty parts, you know, because of what I've done. You actually go looking for it, which means, you know, you actually see it and it gets worse, it all falls apart. But if you have this great positive mind, yeah, you know, you haven't had good sila, you know, you've been misbehaving, or you've been lazy or whatever, but what the heck? You know, you've got some really good qualities in you. So you've got this nimitta, and it's got some dull parts, it's got some shady part, but it's also got a brilliant part. And quite naturally, because of your training, automatically your mind goes to the beautiful part of the nimitta. And that sort of beautiful part just takes up more space in the mind. And that beautiful part of the nimitta, that expands. So you actually almost like going into the beautiful part, it gets more and more beautiful. It starts to really start glowing. And I was messing around with that as often. I just come off a trail, I just remember quite a few times. Sort of, you know, using that sort of technique, seeing lights and just going to the nice part of it. And that's actually just how you do this. This is one way of Abhipramojjhana shining up your nimitta. Getting into that habit of looking at the beautiful part.
So it's gladdening.
That's what's called gladdening, yeah. Abhipramojjhana. It doesn't mean gladdening because nimitta isn't glad. You know, sometimes you're glad or you're upset, but no, nimittas. But it means that they look beautiful, more shiny. Basically, they're more radiant. That's the best way of experiencing it. Just more power, more oomph. And that's why sometimes, you've heard me say this, and this is accurate, sometimes those nimittas get so bright that, you know, it's the first time experiencing it. I'm saying this just to warn you. Sometimes it gets so bright. You know, the idea comes into your mind, I'm going to go blind. This is just too strong. No one can stand this intensity. But remind yourself, this is not seen by the eyes, this is seen by the mind. So you're fine, you can take as much as you want. There's no limit there. But that's actually sometimes what it is like, blinding light, incredibly blinding light, and blinding light, super extreme blinding light. And that means, you really are shining up your nimitta, it's getting up there. But that's always, the more intense that nimitta is, the more powerful that light, just the more bliss you're getting. So yeah, you're getting really a great time. But it's also, with great power, there's also a sense of fear and excitement as well. No, it doesn't actually. This is not many people say this. Some people say colour has this significance, but as far as I've seen, I've seen many colours, I've investigated them, and actually just all the same. It's actually, I'm adding that colour. Now you're a psychiatrist, so you would know this. Now, the way our perception is, you're going on a mental object here, we add the colour. Actually, basically, that what we expect. What we intend to see is actually what we do see there, the particular colour. Sometimes it's like a favourite colour, or sometimes people have these psychic colours. Like the idea of like cosmic blue is a very, very common nimitta colour, simply because many people have looked in the sky and they think that that's a beautiful psychic cosmic colour. Most people it's like white, because like white is a sign of purity. But others like gold, beautiful gold. Purple is a common one. But the most weird colour, which, I've never had this one, but this one fellow had this one. It was, and I investigated, I asked him lots of questions. It was a real nimitta, it was a black nimitta. But it was like one of these like deep, shiny satin black, very deep and beautifully black. And you can understand what that was. You know, that black is not just, always sort of dirty. Sometimes it can be incredibly rich and beautiful and powerful. But I was talking to somebody who came here some time ago, and he was in that centre which was in north of Sydney. It was the Hindu guru, what was his name again? Muktananda, it was Muktananda, that's right, Muktananda. And he was actually describing their practice to me. And their practice was to develop the blue pearl nimitta, they used to call it. This beautiful blue, deep, like pearl nimitta. And actually to merge into that, which was a jhana experience. And that was samadhi. And in that tradition, like that samadhi was their goal, that deep stillness. And because the teacher kept on encouraging this blue pearl nimitta, then people did see the blue. But if I'd have said like the pink nimitta, people had no effect, they'd see it as pink. So the colour is actually just not important. That's which is why the Buddha doesn't actually mention that. Yeah. That may be his nimitta. But when I've looked, I've seen different colour nimittas, and I've gone deeper into them and found, no, actually, I added that. It's just, the way that my perception and added the details there, because it was just my mind hasn't got colour. Maybe anything, but if it gets silver white, it's like incandescent. So it really gets incredibly strong. Yeah?
You mentioned that you encourage us to see light, because you say in
yeah.
That's why you mentioned light. But you mentioned that, you know, because it's in light object, it doesn't matter. Now, if people like in peace and pleasure, like, let's say, the feeling of relief and all that, could the mind stay with that, or should one encourage the mind to see, put attention on light, or could you just go along with the feeling?
Look, it's I've done my job now, because you will see it as light now, because I've done that job of just pointing your perception in that direction.
Right, for no matter what.
So yeah, because this is how you'll see it now. And that's actually, and I've done this purposefully, because you know how this mind works and how it does follow the suggestions, especially in those deep states. And the reason you do that is the light nimitas are far easier to work with. Feeling nimitas, they can get you into those jhanas. They are legitimate nimitas, but they're much more difficult. Because, you know, you don't really know. I think maybe because, you know, that our major sense, you know, in the outside world is sight. And we're much more, have greater facility with sight. And we can distinguish different sights much more than sort of feelings.
So we can just never mind about it because you mentioned it.
Yeah, it will happen now anyway, yeah. Because I suggested that. So that experience, as I mentioned many times before, it's not seen through the sense of sight. Your eyes, sense of sight is closed down. You're seeing it through the sense of mind. The way you interpret it is a sight. That's the nearest, the closest you can get to the experience of nimittas, to the outside world. So that's how you're experiencing it.
Are we going to go through the other nimittas, the sense ones?
Sense ones, not really, because you can't say that much about them. Because most of our perceptual framework is built on sight. Now, sight is a major sense we have. And we don't have that many words, you know, for the feelings in the body.
Sound is much more,
but the sound is the last of the five senses which disappears. It's the first sense which turns on when you wake up in the morning. You hear the alarm clock before you know it, you know that your legs are asleep or you've got an ache somewhere. The sound is, and I think this is because it is the last defense mechanism. We hear the burglar or the tiger sort of coming through the woods through our ears before we see it. So our sense of sound is almost, you know, evolved to be our last line of defense. And so that is very hard to turn the sense of sound off. As you all know, it's so hard not to listen, you know, to noises, to bangs of Zen drums. It's nothing to do with me, but why can't I not hear it? You know, I can close my eyes and not see you. You know, it's pretty simple, reasonably simple, to sit absolutely still and not feel the body. You go to sleep at night, that's what happens. But actually, not to hear things is such a difficult thing to do. That is why the sense of hearing is a troublesome sense. So that's why it's not such a good thing to try and develop that as an imitator.
Because what if you're getting, like, intent? Is that sound so much?
Well, what I'm saying is that experience, don't perceive it as a sound, perceive it as something else. Because if you tend to perceive it as a sound, you hear other sounds as well. And they'll be the real sounds that will disturb you.
Does it matter actually what sense it comes to? It doesn't really matter as long as
in essence, it doesn't matter, but practically, sort of, you know, the mental image of a nimitta is best perceived as similar to a sight.
It's clearer.
Clearer and less troublesome.
Don't you have a tendency to see the beautiful aspect of a nimitta? Is that established or supported by having attitudes in the five sense world?
Exactly.
Is that just a natural tendency that would apply there as well?
There is a natural tendency there. people always say our pussies, you know, always negative, always fault-finding, always getting angry at this and angry at that. And they've got a right to be angry. There's lots of things to be angry about in life. But if you develop that sense, it's very difficult to actually to get beautiful nimittas. It takes much more work. So when you get this beautiful positive mind, oh, just such lovely anagarikas, just lovely food, a beautiful place. What more can you have than just being in Bodhidharma Monastery in a rains retreat? Oh, it's so lovely, it's so peaceful. You start thinking, yeah, there's too much food. And we have to work too hard. And it's just too hot. We need some more rain. The dams are empty. And you start looking at that, and then you can never get that positive mind state to get the joy and the nimittas up.
I'm trying to find
because there's part of the thing which is happening. This is like the will. You become still. But now, things are beginning to happen, and you think, oh no, I don't want it to happen. I'm not ready yet. It's too powerful. Or the power of these states, intensity, as I mentioned earlier, that I'm going to go blind. And it's just too strong. Or sometimes it's just too much bliss. This is too much for me. Well, the other thing is that something's going to happen. And I'm not ready. I don't want it to happen yet. And I've still got kids. I've got something to do. I really just want to watch that movie next week. You know, or in 2 or 3 weeks' time, after the range retreat is finished. Oh, what am I going to do? So this fear and excitement, I said, the two biggest of the upakalesas. And this is actually where it should be, the stilling of the mind overcomes that.
Well,
if you catch it very early, you see excitement coming. See if it's okay.
Rather than you say, I want to see more, what is there?
No, but what Ruben was saying as well, that you can't do very much at those states, because if you really, once excitement gets you, it doesn't have to do very much to get you. You've lost it. Yeah. Well, if your fear comes up, you've lost it. But if it starts coming up, a little bit of it, you can actually calm it down just by. But the best thing is actually to understand it is a problem. It's going to come up for many of you, and the only way to overcome is know it's going to be a problem, know it's there, and train that mindfulness, give it the instructions there. If it comes up, it's okay. And understand what's going on there, the excitement and the fear all comes from a sense of self. Sense of fear is you're losing a lot of yourself, and a sense of excitement, I'm going to attain something. Whee! At last. Yeah, attainments.
Oh,
what are you talking about, nimittas or excitement? Oh, they can come any other way. You can have just a small little speck and have that just grow and grow and grow. You can have just a beautiful screen, and then from out of that, just the beautiful light congeals. There's no end of limits. It's a huge field. It's great fun to mess around there. I was calling it Nimitta Zone in my recent retreat. Getting into Nimitta Zone. Get some great stuff going on in there. So this is the... where do I go? Experiencing the chitta, gladdening or shining up that Nimitta, and stilling that Nimitta. It really helped me to notice again that simile that you're looking in a mirror, as it were. So to still that nimitta, don't do anything. Don't hold the mirror still. Because if you hold the mirror still, the image is still moving. Because I'm moving, stupid. So the one who's looking at that nimitta, that is the thing which has to be still. And once I got that, I figured, oh yeah. And it was so easy just to hold the looker, the observer still. The nimitta was still. And that, because it was a reflection of my mind. If my mind was doing things, Nimitta would be doing things. If I was absolutely still, Nimitta was still. And that's a very good simile. That really helped me. That gave me something to work on. And the last, yeah. Yeah, this is the idea, you don't do anything. That's, you know, the old thing about leave it alone, just sit there.
Is the reason that the limiters are not mentioned in the suttas is that was a sutta that was part of the culture at the time?
They are mentioned in there. They are called the Samadhi Nimitta, or I think they're also called Chitta Nimitta. But especially here, the Chitta here, and the Pabhasara Chitta, is, now I can call
some
it Chitta.
People say that that's a metaphorical.
It is a metaphor in the sense the light is not really a light. But this is, you're seeing the mind, the five senses have disappeared. What else are you seeing? Mm-hmm. It's mind, the last thing which is left. And the last,
in,
sorry.
In the old days, in the days when you were a young monk, and the teachers never mentioned the limitations and all that.
They did, yes, sometimes,
well,
but
it was rarer.
Yeah, you're
talking more about samadhi.
A lot of
deeper. So, did they experience it? Do you think they experienced?
Oh, sure, yeah. They talked about it. Asked questions about it. But the thing was that there was usually the case would be like one-on-one, sort of just talking together. They wouldn't give public talks on those things usually.
They're afraid that people would get attacked.
I'm not quite sure why they were doing that, but I know that somebody told me, I think I've mentioned this to you, and I think in Vietnam, the Sangha there was very well organized, and I don't know how many years ago, they all met together and decided they would not teach jhanas to lay people. Now, why they did that, I don't know, but they said that's just too troublesome. And it was like a whole Sangha decision, the top monks over there. So you can see there has always been a reluctance, actually, to do that. But the 12th stage, I should breathe out, liberating the mind, vimochayang chitang. On that occasion, a monk abides, before it did contemplate in mind, the vimochayang. Vimocha yang is the verb related to vimoka. Vimoka is the noun. So, cook is what you do, then you get the meal. To liberate the mind, to get vimoka, the liberations. And that's always, the eight liberations, always described as the jhanas. So this is actually where you experience the jhanas here. By liberating the mind, you get the jhana. So that's the 12th stage of Anapanasati, jhana. The liberating of the mind. And of course, that's what happens. Get the nimitta, or what you take as a nimitta, this beautiful light, the citta, experiencing it, calm it, make it really beautiful, and then you get free of the body and the five senses and the hindrances, you're in jhana, mate. And that's called contemplating the mind, ardent, fully aware in mind, have put away covetousness and grief for the world. Now this is a really weird thing, which I must say, which the Buddha says over here, this is a very hard thing to get your mind around. So I'm not sure if I can really help very much here, because I don't think anyone's really come up with a really decent explanation of this. I do not say that it is the development of mindfulness of breathing for one is forgetful and not fully aware. That is why on that occasion a monk abides contemplating mind ardent, fully aware, and mind having put away covetousness and grief for the world. So the other ones make a lot of sense. When it says, I do not say that there is development of mindfulness of breathing for one who is forgetful is not fully aware. It doesn't really sort of answer the question there or fit. But nevertheless, that's what's there. Anyway, the next tetrad. On whatever occasion a monk trains us, I should breathe in contemplating anicca, breathe out contemplating anicca, breathe in contemplating, fading away. Brilliant, Bhikkhu Bodhi. Viraga. Sometimes it's called dispassion. But
disenchantment.
But here we've got fading away, which is, in its context, excellent. Trains us, I should breathe out contemplating fading away. I should breathe in contemplating cessation. I should breathe out contemplating cessation. I should breathe in contemplating relinquishment. This is like that Patinissa.
Sorry?
Nisaga.
Nisaga.
Yes, sir, yeah. That's right, Pati Nisaga. Nisaga is throwing things away. For those of you who become monks, we have this Nisagya Paditya. You've received something you shouldn't have received, you have to throw it away. For example, you've received money. And if you receive money, sort of you have to relinquish it in the Sangha, and one monk is agreed upon as being the disposer of that money. And so they have to take that money and they have to go to a thicket or a cliff, and they're supposed to, this is the commentaries, throw it over your shoulder. In other words, don't look where you're throwing it to, as if it was shit. They actually say that. And that's actually how you're supposed to get rid of the money. So you're not just throwing it over there, where is it, so I can get it later on. And that's called nisaga. That's actually throwing things away. So you can understand what pati nisaga means, actually, no, a more intense form of that. So actually just getting rid of things. So there's four things. This is impermanence, anicca, and you remember that anicca is more than impermanence, means that things are liable to totally cease, not constant. Fading away and ceasing. You can see there's almost like a progression here from seeing things as liable to cease and seeing them fading away and seeing them cease. And of course, what you see as impermanent, again, the body, the feelings, the mind, you see them actually fade away. This is actually what happens. They don't suddenly go to see the body fading away in your meditation and your taste and smell and physical sense of touch and sound. They fade away until they totally cease. And then the greatest thing, you see your mind is impermanent. You see your mind fading away, layer by layer, and see it sort of going to a cessation. And contemplating relinquishment, once you see that it's liable to cessation, see it can't be mine, so give it away. So having with wisdom, okay, so these are the next stages of the Anapanasati. So you've got the jhanas, and afterwards you see what has actually disappeared, what's faded away, what cessation is, because in those states there's many things which were always there, now are not there for you. And that really is weird. And so on that occasion, a monk abides contemplating Dhamma, mind objects, as mind objects, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, having put away covetousness and grief for the world. Having seen with wisdom the abandoning of covetousness and grief, which is here meant the five hindrances, he closely looks on with equanimity. With equanimity means that when there's a desire there, the first hindrance, you'd always be bending the truth to see what you want to see. When there's ill will, you'd be bending the truth to hide what you don't want to see. When there's sloth and torpor, you won't be seeing much anyway. When there's restlessness, you won't be there long enough to get some understanding. And when there's doubt, again, you wonder what we're seeing is correct or not. When those five hindrances are overcome, then the vipalasas are overcome. These are the perversions of your cognitive processes, and thereby you can actually look on with equanimity. And only when you can look on with equanimity with a powerful mind can you see Dhamma. So if you've got
equanimity is a fourth jhana.
Not always. It is a fourth jhana. That's the pinnacle of equanimity. When you get to the arupas, it starts to fall apart. Literally. That's a pinnacle. But afterwards, as you would all know, once the five hindrances are gone, that counts as equanimity. So that's actually how you do the four satipatthana. That is how mindfulness of breathing, develop and cultivate, fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. Very brilliant. So there is no difference between satipatthana and anapanasati. So if you do anapanasati, you're doing satipatthana. And how amongst the four foundations of mindfulness, developed and cultivated, fulfill the seven enlightenment factors? Is that on here? Yeah, okay. On whatever occasion a monk abides contemplating the body, ardent, fully aware, mindful, and put away covetousness and grief for the world, on that occasion unremitting mindfulness is established in them. Well, I didn't actually mention that the covetous and greed for the world business is obviously in this context, it's very clear, it means the five hindrances of God. Because unremitting mindfulness cannot happen unless the five hindrances are gone. On that occasion, the mindfulness enlightenment factor is aroused and develops it, and by development it comes to fulfillment. Abiding thus mindful, you investigate and examine that state with wisdom, and embark upon a full inquiry into it. On whatever occasion, abiding thus mindful, the mind investigates and examines that state with wisdom, and embarks upon it a full inquiry into it. On that occasion, investigation of states, enlightenment factor is aroused in them, and you develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in them. Especially here, I would say, you've experienced those jhanas, your mindfulness is incredibly strong, and you look back upon that state, that's the investigation of that dhamma. What was it like? What was happening in there? What was missing? And of course, you've got the simile of the tadpole. Tadpole becomes a frog and realizes that something is missing. You realize that couldn't have been him. And one who investigates and examines that state with wisdom and embarks upon a full inquiry into it, tireless energy is aroused. And of course, I made this very, I think, important nuance with virya. Virya is a Pali word which is associated with the word hero. Now, Vira is like Mahavira, the founder of the Jains, the great hero. So this is not just ordinary energy, it's heroic energy. And especially that part of heroic energy which is willing to abandon, sacrifice anything. Especially the heroic, in those days and perhaps these days, the heroic sacrifice of the soldiers willing to give their life for the country. The heroic sacrifice of the sports person who's willing to sort of put their body on the line in the football match. They don't care about themselves, and that's called that heroic energy. Selfless energy.
Exactly.
This is actually which is what happened here. This is a sequence which is a causal sequence. When one thing is there, the other thing happens also. Once you're mindful, really mindful, of course you're investigating things.
Okay, so this is so because it seems. I guess when you're reading it, it seems like it happens.
One after the other.
No, that it seems like it's like the person, okay, I'm going
to... Oh, no, no.
But in reality, it's automatically after jhana, the mind sees sensation, dukkha, and...
Indeed.
Very quickly all this happens.
This is a causal sequence, and a causal sequence doesn't mean that they happen with a temporal pause. Mm. Happens at the same time. When you're mindful, you're not mindful, and then you investigate... Mindfulness means you're investigating. It means you're seeing deeply into something.
And is it at that time of nibbida? At that time?
And this is actually this. The nibbida comes a bit later in this whole sequence. This is a result of this. Nibbida happens.
But is it at that time that the process is.
And this is more like yata bhuta yana dasana, seeing things as they truly are. Once you get the seven enlightenment factors, nibbida happens, and there's the whole disassociation with samsara occurs.
At that point.
Yeah. So enlightenment factors come first. So let's go to the more enlightenment factors, then we get into nibbida at the end. So you've got mindfulness, incredible mindfulness. You're seeing things there. Energy is always there with that great mindfulness, as I've mentioned there, and it's heroic in the sense. That it can abandon anything, got such strong, it's like courageous mindfulness. And in one who has such aroused energy, unworldly rapture arises in them. This is the anamisa sukha. In other words, nothing to do with like joy or like you've just won $1 million on the lottery. It's not joy that your cricket team has won. It's not joy that your daughter has given birth to a kid. This is the unworldly stuff. This is like the joy of just, you know, having incredible strong mindfulness and seeing all this amazing dhammas. And this mentioned it, on that occasion the rapture enlightenment this factor is aroused in them, they develop it, and by development comes the rapture in them. You can see, also it says, in one who investigates and examines, in one who has aroused energy, in one who is rapturous, this is a causal sequence starting now. The body and the mind become tranquil. This is what happens when you get that great joy. So the body doesn't need to seek for happiness anywhere else. So it gets tranquil. The mind doesn't need to go fantasizing, thinking it's having too good a time. And when you're having a good time, you don't want to go anywhere. So you get tranquility. On whatever occasion, the body and the mind become tranquil and the bhikkhu is rapturous, on that occasion, the tranquility and enlightenment factors arouse in them, and they develop it, and by development, it comes to fulfillment in them. Developing it, fulfilling it, means you don't have to get rid of it. You don't have to sort of abandon it, think you're getting attached. In one whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated, becomes still. This is again one of those sayings which really got me going when I started reading Pali. Samadhang chitta, sukino chitang samadhiyati. The mind becomes still from happiness. Happiness is the cause of stillness. It's the cause of samadhi. It's the cause of deep meditation. And that just really hit me strong here. And this is, again, mentioned here. If your body is tranquil and you feel pleasure, then you get samadhi. You have to have that pleasure there as its proximate cause. On whatever occasion the mind becomes still, in a monk whose body is tranquil and who feels pleasure, on that occasion the samadhi enlightenment factors arouse and they develop it, and by development comes fulfillment in them. And they closely look on with equanimity at the mind thus samadhied, thus still. On whatever occasion the mind closely looks on with equanimity at the mind thus concentrated, thus still. On that occasion, the equanimity enlightenment factors arouse in them, they develop it, and by development it comes to fulfillment in them. So here you've got totally still. Monks, on whatever occasion a monk abides contemplating feelings, this is actually just by doing the body, or by feelings, the same enlightenment factors, contemplating the citta, the same enlightenment factors, or abides contemplating the mind objects, the same enlightenment factors. That is how the four foundations of mindfulness, developed and cultivated, fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. Yeah?
Okay, so it's not like we're not doing intentional sequence at first, which we're saying that I'm kind of having the same thing as the effect of time, which is the same thing as the seven enlightenment factors.
Yeah.
Okay, so I thought.
So it's not just what you do one, and then you do the other, and then you do the other. It's much more efficient, much easier than that. Just do anapanasati and all the other ones get done.
So the same thing as seven enlightenment factors, but yeah.
Parallel, yeah.
Okay.
It's just different ways of describing the same process. So anapanasati, that may be a practice, that's fine, because that includes satipatthana and enlightenment factors. Develop satipatthana, that sort of can include the anapana and enlightenment factors. Just do enlightenment factors. But actually, what you should be doing in practice, you see, we just let go. And these things happen. And how does the seven enlightenment factors developed and cultivated fulfill true knowledge and deliverance? This is where Nibbida comes in. Here, the mind develops a mindfulness enlightenment factor which is supported by seclusion, by viveka. And viveka, there is two types of viveka. For those who weren't here last year, what are the two types of seclusion? You were here last year. You weren't, okay. It's bodily seclusion and citta viveka, which is mind seclusion. What is bodily seclusion? Being in your cave, in your hut, in your little cubby house, wherever you hide out, away from other people, that's called bodily seclusion. And mind seclusion, is when the mind is secluded from the five senses. In other words, at least nimittas, if not jhanas. That's the two seclusions. So these enlightenment factors based on that seclusions. Supported by seclusion, dispassion and cessation. Or instead of dispassion here, fading away and cessation. And ripens in patinisca, relinquishing. In other words, the sign of this is your don't get attached to more things, you want to get rid of more things.
Does that endorse like meditating by yourself in your own room over group meditation?
Yeah, that's the best. However, if you find when you're by yourself you fall asleep, or it's, you know the teaching I've given before is that if you meditate close to your bed, you find that pillows are magnetic. They tend to pull your head before you know it, they caught you. So that's why being like in the Dharamsala or somewhere else, it's a long way from your pillow, so the magnetic field is doesn't get you. And, okay, so you develop the investigation of states enlightenment factor, the energy enlightenment factor, the heroic energy, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the stillness enlightenment factor, the equanimity enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, fading away and cessation, ripens in relinquishing. This is how the seven enlightenment factors developed and cultivated, fulfilled true knowledge and deliverance. So with the dispassion, the viraga, and cessation, this is, in relinquishing, this is where the nibbida comes in. Because you think, what's the point of just keeping all of this? And nibbida is that midway point between seeing things as they truly are and actually taking them off, giving them away, and throwing them out. In the same way as that simile of the dirty cloth sold to the blind man, a great simile in the suttas. And he was sold this dirty old cloth because he was blind. He couldn't see it was oily in a rag, but this con artist sold it to him anyway. And then he got his sight restored and he thought, my God, I've been wearing this dirty, filthy rag, which I thought to be a fine cloth. And of course, what would happen when he sees it's a dirty rag? Ugh, yuck. And he would take it off and throw it away. And that's a Buddha simile about, once you actually see what you're doing, you throw these things away. Nibbida is seeing this body as a dirty, filthy old cloth. And so, you throw it away, you're not concerned about it anymore. So that is... Yeah? Craving is always based on avijja, on delusion. So as delusion is gone, its craving is not there, but you just see, my goodness, what have I been doing? It's a sense of nibbida there.
And then craving...
Craving because it hasn't got any fuel anymore. Dies, the habit goes.
And the source of the craving. Like you'll crave, but then eventually it has to stop craving.
Live seven lifetimes. Now just go back to the word of the Buddha. Just as the elephant hunter drives a huge stake into the ground and chains a wild elephant to it by the neck in order to drive out of him his wanted forest ways and wishes, his forest unruliness, obstinacy and violence, and to accustom them to the environment of the village and to teach them such good behavior as required amongst men. Or just as the abbot of a good monastery drives a huge stake into the monastery and chains the wild anagarikas by the neck in order to drive out of them their wanted lay people's ways. In that manner also should the noble disciple fix their mind firmly to these four foundations of mindfulness so they may drive out of themselves their wanted worldly ways and wishes, their wanted worldly unruliness, obstinacy and violence, and win to the true and realize the Dhamma. So do this, and after a while it does work. You just get brainwashed and conditioned. Yeah, that's, that causes them to develop.
That direction.
Yeah. You get mindfulness. And when you're mindfulness, you can't help but looking at things and investigating them. And you get this energy, which is willing to sacrifice the things which most people won't dare to sacrifice. So it all happens.
The seven factors is just an example. There's 37 factors.
Yeah, that's...
I think it's
all these examples. The Buddha was actually... He wasn't sort of like a mathematician. So I think this was descriptive rather than prescriptive or proscriptive, whatever the word is.
He puts them in all different kinds of groupings.
Yep. Now, I wanted to go on to the Samasamadhi because we'll only have one more time after this, and I wanted to spend the last one on these great sort of gradual training. So now we have in this book the eighth factor, Samasamadhi, right stillness. And of course, you know my predilection towards jhanas, and this is the one factor here which is the worst in the book. And this was the one factor I just almost begged Bhikkhu Bodhi, can't we change this? And he agreed it's not accurate. But now out of respect for sort of the teachers. But what now is right concentration? Its definition. Having the mind fixed to a single object, literally one point is the mind, this is concentration. That is not samasamadhi. This is just one saying of what samadhi is, but not samasamadhi. Samasamadhi, right concentration, is always, every time, not just once, maybe 100, 150 times in the suttas, as the four jhanas.
He accepts that now.
Oh yeah, accepts it, yeah, but didn't
but
change in the book.
He teaches that now. And
it's Yeah. Well, that's...
He'll change it.
Yeah, it's obvious, if anyone reads it, Samasamadhi is always jhanas. However, here we go. Right concentration, in its widest sense, is the kind of mental concentration which is present in every wholesome state of consciousness. That's how the Abhidharma tried to actually to reconcile the necessity for Samasamadhi, for enlightenment, without actually calling them jhanas. But that is really just really off. It's not present in every wholesome state of consciousness. You can have like a wholesome state of consciousness like just feeding the cat. That's kusala. But you know, you haven't got nimittas, you're not blissed out. So it's obviously wrong. And hence it's accompanied at least by right thought, right effort, and right mindfulness. Wrong concentration is present in unwholesome states of consciousness, and hence it's only possible in the sensuous, not in the higher sphere. Samadhi use alone stands in the suit of a samasamadhi. That's usually the case. Not always, though, but most of the cases. Its objects, the samadhi nimitta here. That's what objects means here, samadhi nimitta. This is nimitta here. The four foundations of mindfulness are objects of concentration. Requisites of four great efforts. These are the requisites for concentration. The practicing, development, cultivating these things, that is the development of samadhi. And it's really... not very good that they don't actually even mention jhanas in here, whereas that is always said in the suttas.
But at this time, the Burmese, that was a big one.
That's right, yeah. But anyway, here we go. I'll just read this out anyway. This is the commentary from Jnanatiloka. This is one really good thing. You can tell actually what is from the suttas and what is added here. Right concentration, samasamadhi, has 2 degrees of development. Labeled concentration, upachara samadhi, which approaches the first absorption without having attaining it, and attainment concentration, apana samadhi, which is the concentration present in the four absorptions, the jhanas. These absorptions are mental states beyond the reach of the fivefold sense activity. Great. This is from commentaries. They knew that you can't be hearing things or feeling the body during the jhanas. Attainable only in solitude and by unremitting perseverance in the practice of concentration. Usually in solitude. And unremitting perseverance doesn't mean effort, it means just the commitment of time and skill. In these states, all activity of the five senses is suspended. Brilliant. No visual or audible impressions arise at such time. No bodily feeling is felt. But although all outer sense impressions have ceased, yet the mind remains active, perfectly alert, fully awake. Active in the sense is aware, but not moving. The neighborhood concentration, upachara samadhi, that's not mentioned at all in the suttas. However, I agree that that's a valid term. But as you understand, the neighborhood or the threshold of this hall is what you cross not only to get into this hall, but which you cross on your way out again. There are always 2 upacharas. There's one before jhanas and one after jhana. And it's the one after jhana which is a great one. Because that's the time when the five senses really have been abandoned. They've been knocked out for a while. And if you want to check that out, that's the Nalakapana Sutta.
Is nimitta before the jhana?
nimittas before the jhana. That's But when you come out afterwards, that's the upachara where you get enlightened. The attempt of these absorptions, however, is not a requisite for the realization of four supermundane paths of holiness. Whoa, that is totally against the Buddhist teaching. And neither neighborhood concentration or temple concentration as such possess the power of conferring entry to the four supermundane paths. That's true, they don't confer entry, but without them, you can't enter the paths. Although, stream winner, it's very controversial, and I must admit that the suttas do seem to imply that you can get to be a stream winner without the jhanas, but certainly for the state of anagami and arahat, it's perfectly clear in the suttas you can't get into anagami or arahat without the jhanas, no more than you can get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the sapwood and the bark. That's the Mulokyaputta Sutta 64. Hence, they really have no power to free one permanently from the evil things. They have the power, but you need a bit more. The realization of the four supermundane paths is possible only at the moment of deep insight into the impermanency, miserable nature, and impersonality of this whole phenomenal process of existence. This insight, again, is attainable only during neighborhood concentration, not during attainment concentration. Fine, but you need the attainment concentration to get the neighborhood concentration afterwards where this happens.
It's changed that now, too.
Oh, good. The one who has realized one or other of the four supermundane paths without ever having attained absorption is called Sukha-vipassaka, or Sudha-vipassana-yanika, i.e. one who has taken merely insight as their vehicle. Nowhere ever in the suttas is that mentioned at all. And in fact, the opposite. You do need one of the absorptions, especially for the third and fourth paths and fruits. They, however, who after cultivating the jhanas has reached one of the supermundane paths is called Samatha-yanika, or one who has taken tranquility as their vehicle. The four absorptions. Detached from sensual objects, detached from evil things, a disciple enters into the first absorption, which is accompanied by thought, conception, discursive thinking, is born of detachment and filled with rapture and happiness. Sensual objects is not sensual objects, it's the five senses. Detached from the five senses. In other words, it's viveka, you're secluded from those five senses. You're in one place, the five senses are distant from you. Detached from evil things, it's not such evil things. Evil is a Christian word which means of the devil, against God's law. That means away from the five hindrances. That's what that means. So really it should translate to that. I would say five senses disappeared, no five hindrances. Disciple enters into the first absorption, which is accompanied by thought, conception, discursive thinking. Anybody who's ever meditated to any degree of depth knows that the thinking just stops early on. You're aware, but the discursive thought, the verbal functioning of the mind ceases quite early on in the meditation if you're going to get anywhere. So it doesn't mean thinking. As I said before, in the Chinese version of the suttas, the agamas, they do have a different character for vitaka vichara in the jhanas than they do for the same term outside of jhanas. It just means a different thing. So here, vitaka vichara means the movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object, subverbal. And is born of detachment and filled with rapture and happiness. That should be rearranged as filled with the rapture and happiness born of detachment. That's actually very clear in the Potapada Sutta. And it makes it a lot different. It's filled with the rapture and happiness born of detachment. The detachment, the seclusion from the five senses, is the very cause of that bliss. So you'd actually translate that, which is accompanied by movement of mind onto the object and holding the object, and is filled with the bliss born of seclusion or detachment from the five senses. So, blissed out, afterwards why? Because the five senses have gone. This is the first of the absorptions belonging to the five material sphere. It is attained when, through the strength of concentration, the fivefold sense activity is temporarily suspended, the five hindrances are likewise eliminated. The first absorption is free from five things, and five things are present. When the disciple enters the first absorption, there have vanished the five hindrances. Last still will, tolpa, sloth, and restlessness, and worry, doubts. And there are present, vitaka, vichara, again, movement of the object, movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, piti, sukha, and this stillness. The not concentration, chit, ekagata, It's, if you want to sort of, ekagata is, eka is one, agga, as in agra, the four, that's a Sanskrit word, means that like a peak, a capital, a soaring peak of oneness. These five mental factors present in the first absorption are called factors or constituents of jhana. Again, vitaka, initial formation of an abstract thought, and vichara, discursive thinking, rumination. Outside of jhanas, those things mean that. In jhanas, it means something more subtle. They're not verbal functions at all. Hence, they are something secondary compared with consciousness. In Visuddhimagga, vitaka is, this is actually good. Visuddhimagga compared with taking hold of a pot. So this is the mind taking hold of the object. And vichara with the wiping of it. It's actually holding on to it. It's going on to it, taking hold of it, the initial holding onto it, and then just keeping onto it. In the first absorption, both are present, but are exclusively focused on the subject of meditation, yeah, which is the bliss. Vichara being here not discursive, but of an exploring nature, fine. Both entirely absent in the following absorptions. And further, after the subsiding of that last movement of the mind, subverbal onto the object, holding the object, and by gaining of inner tranquility and oneness of mind. You're already tranquil. It actually says, ajatang sampasadanang. Ajatang means no. Again, internal means that particular experience of bliss. And sampasadanang, it doesn't mean tranquility. It means like literally confidence. It's just like you have faith in something. That's pasada. This faith is also has joy attached to it, like anyone who's really sort of got a lot of faith. Hallelujah, sadhu. So what you have here, you've got faith in the object of meditation, joy in it, so much trust in it, you can let go of that last bit of movement of the mind. It is the last bit of letting go you do. The last bit of letting go which happens. And that's why does it let go? Because you're confident. You don't have to do anything. It's not a willed idea. You don't need to hold on anymore. So you're entering a state free of vitaka vichara, the second absorption, which has a rapture and happiness born of stillness. So again, turn those ones around. With rapture and happiness born of stillness, born of concentration. So the bliss in that second jhana differs from the bliss of the first jhana. The first jhana is a bliss born of detachment from the five senses. This is the bliss born of stillness. Nothing moves now. That vitaka vichara, the last wobble, as I called it in my book, disappeared. Now you're perfectly still, incredibly still, diamond like a rock. Chaitanya has disappeared. The will, nothing's moving here. That's brilliant, weird, but you're having a great time when that happens. Second absorption, there are three factors of absorption, the rapture and happiness, which are all rolled up in one, and stillness, which is rolled up in one. Just three aspects of the one experience. Otherwise, it wouldn't be ekagata. And further, after the fading away of this pity aspect, you dwell in equanimity, mindful with clear awareness, experiencing your own person, the feeling of which no one say, happy they live, who is equanimous and mindful. Thus you enter the third absorption. So this is actually where that aspect of bliss called pity is vanishing. Because things are still, nothing is moving here, stillness begins in the second jhana. After stillness happens, things are going to fade away. So pity is almost like the echo, which you've had before, and the echo fades, and it's gone. And now you have real joy. No, not real joy, sorry, but it's a different type of joy. So this is another type of bliss. Not the happiness and rapture born of stillness, or the happiness and rapture first jhana born of being apart from the five senses. This is a happiness which is actually basically a difference because pity has gone. Now where it says, I always notice this, that whether no one say, happy lives they who is equanimous and mindful. I think this doesn't really add anything to the jhana experience or explaining it. I really think this was one of those sayings which was common in those times, and I think probably what it referred to is not someone in the jhana, but someone who's generally speaking, because you know, it is true that if you're equanimous and mindful, you're a happy person. But no, the Buddha put it in here anyway, and it's stuck. In the third absorption, there are two factors of absorption, equanimous happiness and concentration. Upeka sukha. Already you've got some stillness here. Upeka.
Is that a term in the sutra?
It is, yes. Yeah. And interesting, in the next one. And further, after the giving up of pleasure and pain, after the disappearance of previous joy and grief. So this pleasure and pain is physical happiness, physical vedana, happiness and pain. Joy and grief is the mental happiness and mental unhappiness. You enter into a state beyond pleasure and pain into the fourth absorption, which is purified by equanimity and mindfulness, which is actually the purity of equanimity and mindfulness, not purified by. It's a compound, and that's not merited. With the purification of equanimity and mindfulness, this is where mindfulness and equanimity actually do meet its peak. So because looking at it as a vedana, all bodily five sense vedana disappeared, the mind, the last vedana, the last sense base, it's either pleasurable, unpleasant, or in between. It's just that in between is all that's left. Equanimous, perfectly still. That can't last. If you stay there long enough, things start to vanish because nothing moves. And that's where you get into the arupas, immaterial process. In the fourth absorption, the two factors of absorption, concentration, equanimity, upeka. Is there any sukha in that fourth jhana? Yes, there is. It's again a different type of sukha. The ordinary type of sukha has disappeared. This is actually the real happiness of upeka. So this is actually that playing with words, yeah. And even they say that when the last of the arupas have disappeared, you enter cessation, nothing is felt there.
And that's real happiness.
That's real sukha, paramangsukha, paramatasukha. So it's brilliant, just the understanding of happiness. Ooh. In Visuddhi Magga, 40 subjects of meditation are enumerated and treated in detail, but their successful practice, the following absorptions may be attained. All the four absorptions through the mindfulness of breathing, the 10 kasina exercises, the contemplation of equanimity, and being the practice of the fourth Brahmavihara. So these lead to the fourth jhana. The first three absorptions, through the development of loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy, being the practice of the first three Brahmaviharas. The first absorption through the 10 contemplations of impurity are the 70 contemplations, which are 10 according to the enumeration in Siddhimagga, the contemplation of the body and the parts of the body. Neighborhood concentration of Pachara Samadhi through the recollection of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha on radical liberality, heavenly beings, peace, and death. The contemplation of loathsomeness of food, the analysis of the four elements. Unfortunately, that's wrong. And they always say that Visuddhi Magga was actually based on an earlier work called the Vimutti Magga, which now was thrown away. As soon as Visuddhi Magga was published in Sri Lanka, they threw away all the other commentaries. However, the Chinese still had a copy of the Vimutti Magga. And I've got a copy of that in my room. And here, it actually said, this is actually based on Vimutti Magga, but then Vimutti Magga says all these things, but said for the recollection of the Buddha, only leads to Upachara Samadhi. But then it adds another line, says, but it also leads to jhanas as well. And it's interesting there, that's the earlier book there, it did notice that recollection of Buddha does lead to jhanas. And anyone who's had any exposure to the Thai forest tradition knows that their method of meditation, Buddho, which they take all the way into the jhanas. So actually, they recollect the Buddha with the Buddha mantra, and that takes them all the way. And that is obviously the case there. But even doing things like metta, you get into the metta jhanas, that takes you all the way. The cemetery contemplations, that's, you know, usually the way they use those is like on a bone or something, like usually a skull. And what happens, and this is not that uncommon with monks, you meditate on a skull or on sort of, that's the usual bone which people. The other bones are pretty ordinary and they're just not all that interesting. And, you know, eventually that skull, you know, you can visualize it and it just starts to get brilliant. Mm-hmm. It starts becoming incandescent, becomes your nimitta. Mm-hmm. Once you get the nimitta, then you get into jhanas and you're off just like if you went through the anapanasati.
why are there all these different kind of exercises? You know, like, do you do these things, and that, you know, are there just different people types, or, you know?
Now, what it is I've mentioned is to many people in retreats, you know, first of all, you teach mindfulness of the breath, and some people, they just find they can't do that, so then you teach them Anapanasati. And if they can't do Anapanasati, you teach them loving kindness. If they can't do loving kindness, then you teach them metta. If you can't teach them metta, then you teach them kusinas. If you can't do kusinas, you teach them these beautiful lights. In other words, keep going. Actually, it's exactly the same thing. Just really letting go and just allowing the mind to become still. But a lot of times you do this because people get bored after a while. And sometimes it's true that sometimes people get find it easier to sort of focus on the skull than focus on their breath.
Do you ever hear of anyone who actually can do one practice the whole and go all the way? They always find
They always do, yeah.
Most people find two or three or four.
People don't eat the same food every day. We always have a buffet and just a bit of this today. Sometimes it's some food you really like for a few days and then just be fed up with that and just eat something else. No, sometimes I take other things.
with the recollection of the Buddha, what would be, like, so for Westerners who are brought up living in the culture, would it be just focusing on the inspiration gained by coming across Dhamma? What would you recommend for?
Okay, first of all, I mean, use it like Anapanasati. Just get the thing first of all, and then develop like the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th stages of Piti Sukha based upon that. So, you know, you've got sort of like an image of the Buddha or qualities of the Buddha, whatever, and then just eventually get the joy coming out. And just make the sort of the feeling of the Vedana part of it. The beauty of us is just wonderful, just incredible being this Buddha was. Ah, oh, it just fills me with just so much happiness and joy just thinking about it. And then actually you get the similar to the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th stages of Anapana. And then Nimitta comes up, and then you're doing exactly the same as the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th stages of Anapana.
That's
right.
With
that. Yeah. So basically, you're supposed to, part of that is encourage you to feel all of joy and happiness, mm-hmm. and have that as a mental object, and take that into Nimittas, and take that to jhanas. So just like a skull, you know, to get that to sort of glow, and it's just such an incredible, beautiful skull. I mentioned to people a few times ago, just that old coarse joke, you know, toilet humour, just, you know, one day just getting some nice meditation, having to go to the toilet and seeing the most beautiful turd I've ever seen in my whole life, you know, in the bottom of the toilet bowl. And, you know, it's beautiful. What's happening here is your mind is getting so strong, just the pleasure is just so strong. Anything is pleasurable. And that's an extreme, but that actually happens.
Well, there's a practice in the suttas where the Buddha suggests seeing the unpleasant in the same object and the pleasant,
yeah.
And the unpleasant and pleasant.
That's right. So there's loads of meditations. I mean, it gets beautiful, and you just can't help it. So the 4 material absorptions, the arupa jhanas, which are based on the 4th absorption, are produced by meditating on the respective objects from which they derive their names. Sphere of unbounded space, unbounded consciousness, nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception. I don't like unbounded space, I sort of unmeasured space, I think I said, or unmeasured consciousness, when a space is just losing its meaning. And the usual, the simile which I give, the only metaphor I found useful in teaching is the metaphor of being in the present moment. Because when you get present moment awareness, you've got infinite time. In other words, time has no meaning for you anymore. You've got all the time in the world, but it's no time at the same time. It's actually the measuring of time is disappearing. Now that gives you an idea of what it means by this unbounded space and unbounded consciousness. Space is just nothing space there, but it's also infinite at the same time. So it's basically, it's disappearing. Consciousness is disappearing. It's got no meaning anymore. Just like time begins to disappear in the present moment. So, now it gets to the last page. Develop your stillness. For he or she who has stillness understands things according to their reality. So, and remember I said, take away concentration, call it stillness. Mm-hmm. And that's far more meaningful. When the mind is still, you see things as they truly are. And what are these things? They're rising and passing away of body, feeling, perception, mental formation, and consciousness. Just another five khandhas. When you're really still, you see they come and go. So what? Thus, these five khandhas, the five groups of existence, must be wisely penetrated. Ignorance and craving must be wisely abandoned. Tranquility and insight must be wisely developed. This is the middle path which the perfect one has discovered, which makes one both to see and to know, and which leads to peace, to discernment, to enlightenment, to nibbana. And following on this path, you too will put an end to suffering. I'll pause there. He didn't say, maybe you will, maybe you won't. He didn't say that, well, it depends, you know, whether you are Indian in the time of the Buddha of the Khatriya class. He didn't mention that. There's no requirements except to follow the path. And that's a powerful statement. If you follow that path, it's only one sentence, though. If you follow that path, you will put an end to suffering. Period. So, that's powerful. So you know what to do. Just keep trucking.
Well, because we never do it. If we did it, we'd be there.
That's right, because we still keep going this way and that way. But, there we go.
We fool ourselves to think we're doing it. Handamayam mawada dhamma kataya sadhu karanda dhamma se
sadhu 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 anumodami.
Very good. So the next Saturday will be the final chapter. And again, it's great because it's going to just put the whole of the Eightfold Path just in a different context. Just a gradual training. Exactly the same, looked at from a different perspective. It's brilliant. It's in so many suttas. So the gradual gradual training is in this. It's the first. It starts off in the second sutta, Samanyapada Sutta. It just reoccurs so many times that you look it in here and it says refer back to, I think, number 72, where it's first said in the Majjhima Nikaya. So it's so often, this is so often repeated as a great description of the path.